And good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Monday, President's Day, very rainy Monday, February the 19th, 2018, 16 minutes past the hour. Scott Spears along with you on the Now program. And we have got a great program set for you today. Now today, I do want to remind you something interesting, kind of in accordance here with the station. Today is the 50th anniversary of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood going on public television. And as the week goes on, we have some very interesting guests from the Mr. Rogers history. So stay tuned. Wednesday and Thursday, we have some very important guests to celebrate 50 years of Mr. Rogers going on the air, although today is the actual 50th anniversary, President's Day. And we also have a politician coming on, I believe Thursday, that I think you're going to enjoy. We have not totally confirmed that yet, so I'm not going to let the cat out of the bag. But it's somebody who I'm sure you've heard of, a very long lineage in politics, political family. But our guest this hour is going to be a lot of fun, especially on President's Day. He is an attorney. He has written two books. One, very close to Marianne's heart, The Harding Affair, Love and Espionage During the Great War in 2009. Also, January 1973, Watergate, Roe versus Wade, Vietnam, and The Month That Changed America Forever. That was released in May 2015. He has done lectures with John Dean on Watergate and has another book on the way very soon. Always glad to welcome to these microphones to have a discussion about presidents and President's Day, or Washington's birthday, however you refer to it, Jim Robinault. Jim, how are you?
I'm great, Scott. It's nice to talk to you.
It's always good to talk with you. I want to start with the president the station is named after. Obviously for reasons that are easy to figure out. President Harding, he's still rated usually in the bottom five or bottom ten, even after your book, which I thought might change some things. Why is that?
It's a very long and complicated story, but I believe that it has to do with the fact that right after he died, there was nobody to really carry his legacy on, and his wife then died a year later. And at that, from that point forward, it was kind of a shutdown of people who were worried about Teapot Dome and stuff like that, and it snowballed from there. So he really needed somebody to carry the torch back then. And, of course, it went into the Great Depression, and then the Democrats took over for a long period of time. So that's during the time when a lot of his biographies were being written. And so that's kind of the general answer. There's a much deeper answer that I think deals with racism and other things that have to do with why he's rated that way. But it's all incorrect.
As far as the man, if we want to be proud about him, if we want to tout him around, what are some of the things that we should say?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I see there's a difference. There's somebody who just wrote something in the New York Times, a scholar out of Princeton, in which he was starting to talk about the things that Harding actually accomplished. And I think that has to do with John Dean's book, my book, and other people who are now really looking, taking a hard look at Harding. Harding was actually a very good president. First of all, he inherited a world that was in real chaos after the First World War. Europe was financially bankrupt. The only stable democracy in the world was the United States. And we had real economic troubles because people had spent so much money on war effort during the war that the economy was overheated, and then it was collapsing. So he had a lot of things that had to go right during his presidency, which did go right. And so the world has Warren Harding to thank for stabilizing the world. And you just can't say enough about that. How many presidents have that as their legacy, in addition to obviously some other things that I can talk about, but that's the main thing that he did.
You know, the affairs are brought up quite a bit. One that produced a child. Why does that stick to him, and FDR's affairs, which came later, really don't stick to him as badly?
You know, it's funny. Again, I think he did not have somebody to protect his legacy after he was gone, which is a shame. But, you know, obviously the main reason that the affairs became so notorious with him is because of the President's Daughter, the book that was written in 1927 by Nan Britton. And I think that had a lot to do with sticking that tag on him. The book was very salacious and, you know, widely read. So I think that came out. There's no similar book for FDR. There was a lot written about John Kennedy long after he was dead. But it really, that book, I think, is the thing that caused the problem.
Two books that were the definitive manuals for President Harding up until your book were The President's Daughter, which you've mentioned, which I think we now know why that was written, because she was telling the truth, right. Nan Britton. And then the other one was The Shadow of Blooming Grove. Why the author of that? What was he trying to prove? What was the point?
Well, first of all, he's like a Harvard-educated, I think he was Canadian, Francis Russell is his name. And he wrote for The History Magazine back at the time, American Heritage Magazine. So he was a guy who had a lot of credentials and was a really very skilled writer, a very skilled researcher. But somewhere in Marion today are a collection of his letters that he wrote that I think you have in your museum. Somebody has the whole collection in a file cabinet. I read through large numbers of them at one point. And what you find out from his personal correspondence at the time is he was really activated by race. He was a tremendous racist, and he believed that Harding had African-American blood. Interestingly enough, because of all this testing that was done to figure out whether or not Nan Britton's story was true, the Harding members who did get tested have no African blood. So, I mean, that was totally scurrilous at the time to say that. Today it would be a badge of honor, but back then it was not. And Francis Russell was convinced of it. And if you read his personal letters, you'll see him writing to people about how he was thinking about naming the book The N-Word in the Woodshed. So, I mean, it just gives you a feel for what he thought about Harding. He had a low opinion of him because of racist views. And while his book seems very highly researched and it's very highly readable, the fact of the matter is the title itself tells you that he was on a racist rant. The Shadow of Blooming Grove is the race rumor. And he just... You know, so he attributed all the awful things to him that racists did to African Americans at the time: oversex, stupid, never read books. I mean, just a lot of stuff that was incorrect. And he definitely had an agenda, and it comes out in these letters. That would be a good book for somebody to write, frankly.
You know, being in Marion, Ohio, the things you always knew about President Harding, of course you knew about Teapot Dome and the affairs, and you kind of put that over there. But the positive qualities that people always said about Harding: he was an amiable guy, he was a good-looking guy, he was elected in the first presidential election that women had the right to vote in. But then when the Nan Britton story comes out, and we think he knew that he had a child, there's no mention of her in the will, which was written 2 months before he died, or at least tweaked 2 months before he died. He didn't leave her any money. He didn't acknowledge. Was he a good guy? I mean, that's an opinion. We didn't know him. Do you think he was a good guy?
You know, that's a really tough one to deal with. And, you know, especially now in our Me Too world, you know, I think what he did with Nan Britton is something that a lot of men of power did back at that time. They had mistresses, and they all treated them the same way, which is, that is to say, they didn't acknowledge them. They tried to provide for them if they felt like it. I mean, these women were very much at the mercy of these strong, powerful men. And part of the reason that Nan Britton wrote the book was that. If you've read it recently or remember it, she kind of dedicates it to unwed mothers. And, you know, it was just, it was a travesty the way women were treated back then. And he was part of that. So you have to judge him correctly there and say that was, you know, he should not have done that. He should not have failed to acknowledge his relationship with her, and as it turns out, his own daughter, his only child. So on that scale, it's hard to say he's a good guy. On the other hand, on the scale of whether he had progressive policies and whether he was a good human being overall, I think he was. But I do think that he acted a lot like powerful men continue to. I mean, think about, Scott, just the revelations we've had in the last few months about Donald Trump and Stormy Daniels and these other things. I mean, it is a hallmark of some powerful men, and it's a horrible thing, and it's something that is now really starting to rightly set its place in the moral discussion of the country.
Something that recently has struck of high interest to me in regard to President Harding, I recently read his will, and two things that struck me odd about it were that he rewrote it just 2 months before he died, which could have just been a coincidence, but he rewrote it 2 months before he died, that his father is mentioned in the will, which my assumption has always been that President Harding didn't know he was dying, and usually people don't put their parents in their will because they think they'll outlive them. And there is a stipulation in that will that says this will shall not be contested. This is the definitive will, written less than 60 days before he died. Does any of that strike you strange?
You know, it might. I think he knew he was really suffering from heart problems, and that's what he died of. And he's, 58 years old, but he was having trouble sleeping at night. He had to, sit up with pillows. It was classic heart failure that he suffered from, and he was around doctors enough. His dad was, his brother was a psychiatrist, but he was a physician, and of course they had the one guy who was kind of a quack who helped the Duchess, as they called her. But I think he had to have had suspicion that he was in some danger of the kind of imminent death or the instant death that people had back then from cardiovascular problems. I think he knew he suffered from it. His blood pressure was very high. So it wouldn't surprise me at all if he thought his dad, who was a very interesting character in his own right and strong and healthy and former Civil War soldier type guy, that he might have suspected that his dad was going to outlive him. And his dad, I think, suffered from financial difficulties, so him putting him in the will makes sense to me.
I think people in Marion, we don't want to talk about Teapot Dome, and even though we know about the grandson and the daughter now, we really don't like to acknowledge that a whole lot. But how are we positive, because it's the other big question, how are we positive that Florence did not poison him, or at least have some hand in his death? We certainly know she had motive.
Yeah, number of years ago, I helped to come up with the idea of having this symposium in the summer, the Harding Symposium with Ohio State. And maybe the second or third version we did of that a couple years ago, Richard Harding, who is one of the great nephews, came to give a presentation along with Sherry Hall about Harding's death and his last days in the Palace Hotel. And Richard very convincingly put up the medical charts and showed exactly what was going on with him, because Harding was being attended to by the dean of the Stanford Medical School, and these were very experienced physicians at the time who kept very detailed records, and nurses were there around the clock with him. He clearly died of heart failure, and he clearly was having heart failure at the time that he died. So the evidence is irrefutable that that's what was going on. He didn't just suddenly die of poison. He was clearly in distress. Richard's presentation was very dramatic, just the panting that he was doing at that time to catch his breath, you know, how many breaths per second or per minute that he was doing. He was literally panting at the end of his life because he was his heart was failing. So that's not any indication of someone who's been poisoned. It's someone who's dying of heart failure. Very convincing to me.
Anytime scholars put together these lists of greatest and worst presidents, it always seems like Franklin Roosevelt and Abraham Lincoln flip-flop on who is one and who is two. Roosevelt is still hated by quite a number of people. It was interesting. Last week we were talking about presidents with a group. I was talking with a group of people. And a young kid who is just in college expressed this great disdain for Roosevelt. Should he be number one?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You're talking to the wrong guy because you may or may not recall my great-grandfather, who was from Kenton, Ohio, was his Register of the Treasury. His name was W.W. Durbin. He also started the International Brotherhood of Magicians. That's actually my first book called Linking Rings. But he very much, supported Roosevelt. He's the guy who told Jim Cox in 1920 to pick him as a vice presidential candidate. And then in 1932, he helped him get the nomination in Chicago. So we are very much a New Deal family. And the reason Roosevelt should be number one, even above Lincoln, who obviously I revere very much too, but he faced two of the greatest challenges of any president of any time. The Great Depression and then World War II. And he conquered both of them with his willpower, with his skillful guidance, and all of us, this country is here today because of him. So I think he's clearly number one. And the people who attack him are people, in my view, who are conservatives who just don't think very much about what they're saying. For all those people who want to attack Franklin Roosevelt, I'd be happy for all of them to disclaim their Social Security benefits and all of their parents and their grandparents and everybody else who's benefited from that. That was needed. It's important to our country. It's important to the health of our economy. And he actually did a lot of good things that make us a much better country.
When these lists come together, another person who's always usually in the top 10 is John Kennedy. For being in office such a short time, does he deserve that, or is that just sadness for the way he left?
More sadness for the way he left. He really didn't accomplish all that much during his term. In fact, he was in office about the exact same time as Warren Harding. Harding accomplished much more during his time. Kennedy had the ballistic missile matter, but he provoked the Cuban Missile Crisis by mishandling. And he also, in his inaugural, which everyone worships, said, "We will bear any burden, pay any price to support our friends and foes, and oppose our foes." That bear any burden problem got us into Vietnam, and that was very problematic. He also did very little for civil rights at the end of the day, because he was very cautious at the time about how to do it. It took his death and Lyndon Johnson to get the 64 Act and the 65 Act. Query whether John Kennedy would have been able to get that stuff through had he not died under the circumstances he did, and Lyndon Johnson then get the great landslide that he got. But it really did take LBJ to do it. So I think while Kennedy is charismatic and had a lot of great ideals, I don't think he accomplished very much.
A president that is kind of always, he's a strange, let me explain, he's a strange dichotomy in my mind, is Dwight Eisenhower. Mm-hmm. Dwight Eisenhower was very popular. He was able to win two terms very easily. Obviously, very decorated war hero from World War II. People loved him. But yet, people forget Thurgood Marshall won separate but equal in the 50s. Eisenhower would not enforce it. Now, Kennedy didn't either, but Eisenhower didn't as well. And he didn't have to win re-election. He never enforced it. And he also campaigned for McCarthy in Wisconsin during the communism scare, and he never denounced McCarthy. What was Eisenhower? It seems strange.
I'm not sure that he didn't do anything to enforce Brown v. Board. I'd have to look at that, Scott. I just don't. I take you at your word that's the case, but I'm not sure he did. He did have a fairly good civil rights record. But in terms of where he stands among the presidents, again, I think that his two terms were important because obviously the economy began to roar during the 50s, and that was a real time of growth for our nation. The thing about him as president that I think we all should admire and think about on this President's Day is that, having been, you know, a warrior, he transitioned into the presidency and then, most importantly, warned all of us that the military-industrial complex is something that we shouldn't fall too much in love with. We had just won this war. We were the mighty United States of America, and I think what he was saying is, don't let the military and the industry take over the country's values, because it is there for a reason. It does its purpose, but it can become its own machine and get us into doing stupid things. And in fact, I think that's turned out to be true with a lot of the wars that we've engaged in, even in the last decade, let alone Vietnam. And so I think he had the wisdom of a warrior, of knowing when it's important to war, how you do it, how you wage it, but then how you build a country that is not war-based. So I think that was the extraordinary part of Eisenhower.
I want to go back on this Eisenhower. He did try to enforce it. I guess he didn't. People were still going along with it, and there were still separate drinking fountain schools, so on and so forth. Yeah. And I don't think until Johnson made a law.
Yeah,
you know.
I mean, what your fundamental point is right, that Jim Crow took over in the South after the Civil War and was vile, and presidents were reluctant to rock the boat. And Democratic presidents in particular, because the South was entirely Democratic, and so you had, you know, some of the greatest racists that ever have been in Congress from the South, and yet people like John Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson needed to depend on those people to be able to get the presidency. So it was a high wire act, and there was not as much courage as you would have hoped from any of them on all of those issues.
Well, that's what confuses me, because I can kind of rationalize Kennedy saying, I got to get reelected in 64, so I don't want to enforce it now. But Eisenhower wasn't going for reelection. He'd already won his second term. So I don't know what he had to lose by not trying to enforce it harder.
I'd have to look back. I thought he did send federal troops down there at some point to maybe it was with Mississippi. I'd have to look back.
I think he did, but I think he just didn't. He wasn't able to erase it in the way that Johnson did.
Yeah, and that is a good point, because what you really have is a system in the South of total segregation and total injustice, and you have, the Democrats have to play favor to it because it's a Democratic South, and people like Eisenhower, who is by nature a conservative and doesn't want to get too much into social engineering, but they look the other way with respect to some really awful things that were going on in the South. There was a lot of lynchings and other things. There just should have been a lot more emphasis on it. I couldn't agree with you more on that. I do think Eisenhower tried somewhat, but I think he was just fundamentally a conservative person. And it really did take Lyndon Johnson to be the guy from the South who was going to change everything, and it took a lot of crises to get him there. Martin Luther King Jr., obviously, provoking with his Birmingham campaign, the 64 Act, and then Selma, the 65 Act. Johnson did his part and really knew that the Democrats would pay a price. And as a result, today, the South is entirely Republican.
And the other part of that, McCarthy, I don't infer that Eisenhower liked McCarthy. I don't think he did. It was interesting, because if anybody could have stopped him, if anybody could have And I think he worked to stop him through letters and things like that then. But if anybody could have said, stop this, Eisenhower could have. And I don't know why he didn't.
I don't know enough about what specifically he did with McCarthy. The fact of the matter is Bobby Kennedy worked for McCarthy. There were a lot of people with dirt on their hands because of the House Un-American Committee activities. And fortunately, that thing burned out, and he burned out. I think your fundamental point is right, that we elect presidents to show moral leadership. And that was a time when people were acting in ways that were very anti-American and very undemocratic. And so to the extent he didn't put enough pressure on the Congress at that time, that is something that is a mark against him.
And then we move up to his vice president, who eventually got into office, Richard Nixon, and certainly did not leave on the best of terms. But his presidency, if we could chop that end off, where does Richard Nixon's presidency fall?
He would be pretty highly ranked in foreign policy, and he would be, I think, in the middle in terms of domestic policy. But his forte was foreign policy. He really did learn under Eisenhower in his 8 years as vice president to become president. And by the time he became president, he was highly focused on foreign policy. So obviously his greatest accomplishment was to open China, and that has had good and bad effects, but mainly good and an important thing, and that's his big deal. He also, to his credit, ended the war in Vietnam. To his discredit, he sabotaged Johnson's effort to end it in 68 and then kept it going for a long while, and then his peace was not a peace with honor, as I explore in my January 73 book. It was, you know, he knew, and Kissinger knew, this peace was not going to last. So in a way, it was kind of a false narrative. But to his credit, he did end the war. We needed to get out of that war, and we needed to end that part of our history and move on. So I think on those things, on the foreign policy front, he is going to be seen as someone who did the right thing for the most part, although very mixed bag with Vietnam. On the domestic front, he, you know, was much more progressive. He would not even be in the Republican Party today. Started the EPA and even looked at price controls. He was very much a progressive. And it's interesting, his two heroes as presidents were Woodrow Wilson and Theodore Roosevelt, both progressives. Those were the guys who he really looked up to. And so on that front, he was surprisingly progressive in his policies.
Interestingly enough about Nixon, without getting into the whole Watergate thing, which we all know about, if you had to take one mistake, if he would have just done this differently, how could he have avoided that? At least leaving office.
Very interesting you ask that. John Dean and I have been doing programs across the country for the last seven years, and we've probably done about 150 of them. The most recent program we do compares Nixon and Trump and their personalities, but we also, at one point in the program, take people back to the week after the break-in. There are tape recordings in the Oval Office. That is the week that there's the 18.5-minute gap is created, but there's just a ton of other material on those tapes. And one day, on the Wednesday following the break-in, Nixon actually says on a tape to his chief of staff, you know, these sorts of things come out, and there's no real good in putting a tissue around it, in other words, covering up, because it eventually comes out anyway, and we really should just get it all out. He was really on top of it. That would have saved his presidency. But 2 minutes later, he says, but if this is going to hurt John Mitchell, who was his good friend, who helped him become president, who was his attorney general, who he had moved back over to the campaign in March, who had approved the Watergate break-in, and he suspected that. He said, if this is going to hurt Mitchell, then we can't do it because it would destroy him. So his loyalty, literally, to his friend, John Mitchell, is the thing that took him down. He should have followed his instinct that you can't cover stuff up like this and just gotten it all out that week and fired Mitchell and fired these other people. He still would have won by a landslide, and that was his grave error, was this acting in a way that he didn't want to take the sure loss.
This is what fascinates me, because is it safe to say Nixon did not order and did not know that the Watergate break-in was going on? I mean, is that a safe assumption to make?
That is.
Okay, if he didn't, so his, you know, his failing was trying to cover it up.
Right, right. Well, there are two failings. One is that he established a culture within his administration, and this is so important for presidents in any organization. The culture is set at the top. His culture was to be extra legal. In other words, the year before Watergate, he is pounding the table, and it's on a tape, asking people to illegally break into the Brookings Institution to get the Pentagon Papers. And so he set that tone, which is, I'm the president. If the president does it, it's not illegal. And that tone infused these people who ended up doing Watergate. So while he didn't know the specifics of Watergate and didn't approve it, he had approved the culture and had set the culture. So it's both that and then his covering up afterwards to try to keep it under wraps.
I bring this up for this reason. You're doing a thing with John Dean now comparing Trump. On Friday, 13 Russians were indicted, three Russian companies. Now, interestingly enough, in these indictments, it spells out by name Kellyanne Conway, Don Trump Jr., had retweeted things that were clearly negative to Hillary Clinton. We believe Don Trump Jr., pretty well know, had a meeting with people who he thought had negative information on Hillary Clinton. Nixon didn't know about Watergate. I don't know if Trump knew that this was going on, but he certainly went along with it.
One of the parallels that, if you know, you and I have to walk 2 or 3 years into the future to see what's really going to happen here, but one of the parallels between what Nixon did and what is going on with the Trump administration is this whole illicit activity during a presidential campaign. With Nixon, you have people literally breaking into the Democratic National Committee. With Trump, there are Russians who are electronically breaking in, and now we know electronically trying to sway the election towards him through social media and so forth. So the first question is the Howard Baker question: what did he know and when did he know it? And like you, let's take an assumption that he didn't know about this. But one of the questions is, was he willfully looking the other way, kind of knowing, nod and wink and so forth, or is there more to it? But then the next question is, if he didn't know about it, has he been in a campaign to try to stop the investigation and to cover up what he's worried about, that he does know about or that other people in his administration knew about? And is that the same thing? And that's why people keep asking, is there an obstruction of justice here that's going on with the firing of the FBI director and with the attacks on the Mueller investigation? All of that very much harkens back to Watergate and very much has parallel in Watergate.
I think the confusion is, I would have loved to have asked, if I could get one question to Richard Nixon, my question would have been, the Democrats didn't have a chance in the world of beating you that year. Why was this going on? Why was this break-in going on? Different with Trump, Hillary Clinton had 3 million more votes. Very possibly she could have won. There was a lot of negative things going on in Trump's campaign, like the Access Hollywood video. That's where I think they become very different. Because I don't think Nixon would have lost, irregardless of what happened at Watergate. But Trump could have.
Yeah, for sure. There's no question that Nixon didn't need to do what he did. But the activity that started with Gordon Liddy and the plumbers and these guys planning all these you know, break-ins and illegal activity started, you know, half a year earlier, before Nixon had even gone to China and begun to really solidify himself. If you look at Nixon, barely won in 68, and he was genuinely worried about 72 because he had lived through Kent State and Cambodia and a lot of turmoil as a result of the war. So this all starts when it wasn't all that certain that he was going to be reelected. And then it just has its own, you know, momentum and keeps going during that period. So in a sense, he was. It didn't start with the everybody knew we were going to crush him, why do this? But with Trump, there is no question that he was on the ropes and having great difficulties, and there's no question that he needed help and assistance, and I think there's no question his son, at least in that meeting, was very happy to get that assistance from the Russians. So we'll see how this all plays out, but I think there's an awful lot of smoke here to suggest that they knew what was going on and needed the help in order to win the presidency.
What I think is different with Trump, and I think we will bear this out with time, is that we have a professor who's on once a week, Dr. Ron Feynman, the progressive professor, and he's written a few books, historian. Now, he claims that Trump will either leave or be impeached by May. I don't know, that's getting awful close. But if that were to happen anytime during Trump's first term, because of meddling in the election system, which we're positive happened as of last Friday, are people really going to be content just to say, well, Hillary, you probably would have won. You probably should have won. Sorry. Yeah, I mean, I don't know.
Yeah. No, I don't think so. And I think that whatever happens here, a lot of thought has to go into what it is. Impeachment, while it might be satisfying to some people, could be disastrous because it could really divide the country in a way that we've never seen before. And we're on that. You know, in ways, much better that the Congress change in this year and that he gets voted out by the regular process. It is really disruptive to get rid of a president through impeachment. And especially now that we've got, I mean, half the people listening to this broadcast are going to say they disagree with us, and half are going to say they agree with us, and there's little we can say to any of them that would convince them that they're wrong about their position. So we live in a time that things are really dangerously divided, and against that we have to weigh, is it dangerous to have this guy in the presidency? I happen to think it is, but I also think that there's a real, you know, there has to be a lot of thought about what happens from here forward. Much of it will depend on how substantial the evidence is. If there has been treason and espionage, I mean, there's no question what we have to do. But if it's really difficult to figure out what it truly was and what truly happened, that makes it a much more difficult situation.
I think anybody leaving office is going to be very difficult, but if it came down to that, if I was the Speaker of the House, because I find it highly unlikely that if this collusion or what did they know, highly unlikely Pence wouldn't have known about it either, being the head of the transition team for a lot of this. If Pence and Trump both went, resign, impeachment threats, whatever it is, I can't imagine that Paul Ryan would just assume the presidency, even though that's the idea. If it was found out that the election was stolen, which we're getting very close to saying, if I was him, I don't know what you'd have to do legally, but, you know, when a mayoral election is if they find out that something went wrong, they either rehold the election or they reverse it. Republicans, if this happened, are going to have a very tough time, especially before November, getting reelected. I would want to get a Democrat in there just to campaign against him and saying, look at the disaster, because the person who walks into that after Trump or Pence, that's going to be a nightmare.
Yeah, it's interesting. There's been some articles written recently about what the guy who was the Speaker of the House was going to do when Nixon resigned, because he was a Democrat. And the question of what to do was up in the air because Agnew had to resign. And for a period of time, the question is, if Nixon got impeached, he didn't have Ford yet. He would get him. But, you know, what would the Speaker of the House do under that circumstance? And interesting what-ifs to think about. I can't imagine that both Trump and Pence would go if Trump either resigns or gets impeached. So I hopefully you wouldn't come to that result. But this all this stuff is very dicey and very problematic. And but we got to get to the bottom of it, because if something really bad happened here that is really perverting our democracy, we really cannot let it stand.
And on the last note of that particular part of history, I don't think Hillary Clinton's George McGovern either. I just don't think she just says, that was tough luck. I don't know. I don't know what she could do, but I think that would be a real problem for her, a real problem for her husband, who's a former president, and a real problem for the man who was president at the time, and Democrats in this country in general. I think that'd be very interesting. Three presidents I want to end talking about. Reagan, Obama, and Clinton are all starting to be in the top 10 list. Clinton sometimes falls out based on personal issues, but they're all very high. Do they belong there?
I would say that Reagan belongs there. He represents a conservative point of view, and I think he did what he said he was going to do. He was a positive leader. He left a lot of positive things. There were some, in my view, negative things that he did that really hurt the economy, and a lot of Ohio is decimated because of what happened during the Reagan years. Nevertheless, I think he still was a positive presence in the country, and I think he was also, you know, the Berlin Wall fell because of him, and there were a lot of things he did, I think, that we can look back and say he deserves to be treated with respect. Bill Clinton, I'm out on him, and I used to be a big supporter of his, but his a lot of the things that he did while he was president trouble me. His three strikes, you're out, lock them up. You know, we have more African Americans in jail and in prison than ever, and he was a part of that problem. In that, he also was a part of the problem in the way he dealt with welfare. On the other hand, he definitely, I think, had a steady foreign policy, and he obviously left the country with a surplus, which, you know, who else is going to do that? He took the hard task of increasing taxes to get rid of that surplus, and we're all in, again, dangerous territory because of deficits. So he should be given respect for that. President Obama deserves respect just because he was the first African-American president, two terms. And you know, I think he did a lot of very positive things too. I think he was a very positive leader. But, you know, it was a really divisive time and has resulted in a lot of divisiveness. So it's hard to really tell. We're too close to his being in office to say how he's going to rank. I would rank him up there with one of our better presidents.
The only president who in recent times rates really low, in the bottom 10, W. Bush, does he belong there?
Yeah, I think so. I think he was, I personally like, this is the way I've always felt about George Bush. I kind of like the guy from everything I've seen. He seems amiable. His father I liked. But he just got us into disastrous wars that we shouldn't have been in. And he did it in a reckless way, and he let some of the neocons in his group run the show, and he's going to have to live with that. I mean, that record is horrific, and we're still paying the price.
What path are we on with President Trump? I mean, it's very hard to say where he would end up, but what grade would you give the first year?
F. I really have, and I will just speak for me. I think that he is a disaster as a president. I think that he has sown discord. I think he is false in almost everything he says. I think there's nothing morally about him that anybody could find attractive. He really is exactly the wrong person in that office. I have no idea whether his tax break is going to be the right thing or the wrong thing. That's the only thing that really has happened during this time. Otherwise, it's been a complete disaster, in my view, and I really find him reprehensible. So that's how I feel about him. Other people may feel differently, but I would give him an F.
Who would you think right now, and we're a ways away, but people are starting to ramp up after this year will be over, who's going to be the Democratic nominee? Is Biden going to run? Hillary again? Sanders? Warren? Kennedy?
I don't think we know, and I think Biden's too old. I like Joe Biden, but I think he's too old. Hillary should get off the stage. She was a disaster as a candidate every time she ran. Too much baggage. Rightly or wrongly, it's a problem. And the Democratic Party needs fresh leadership. But Bernie Sanders is also way too old. We need younger people with vision who represent not just the generations that are on their way out, but you know, you've got a really interesting group of people coming up. And you see it in the Florida disaster with, you know, those students really showing some real class in leadership. There's a lot to be happy about and optimistic about in terms of our young people and who they are and what their politics are going to be. But we need people who will speak for them because it's their world that the, you know, is coming up.
Before we part, you said Roosevelt should be number one. Who is dead last, in your opinion?
Oh, somebody like, you know, Polk or Buchanan. Some of those guys who we barely know about, but who did, you know, really awful things and were terrible presidents and, you know, should never have been in the office. But we really should look at, like, the last 100 years, because prior to that, it's really Lincoln and Washington that are important. Everybody else is, you know, is significant. But I do think that in the last 100 years, a guy whose stock is falling is Woodrow Wilson. And I was a big proponent of Wilson 20 years ago, but the more I've studied him, he was a terrible racist, and I think he made huge mistakes at Versailles that brought on World War II. So he's a guy whose stock, in my view, is falling precipitously.
Mm. Do you have a pick for best first lady of all time?
There are a lot of them. I really like Michelle Obama. I really like Laura Bush. I think both of them. The greatest first lady of all time, clearly, again, is you're going to get my prejudice here, but is Eleanor Roosevelt. She really remade things and was really just a truly great human being. So, I mean, I put her right up there as one of the best. Florence Harding, by the way, was a pretty good first lady.
But the one who probably did the most is Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, and I think just too much baggage from the Clinton years. Too much baggage. It's a shame. Their presidency was a tragedy because they had so much good stuff going for them. They were smart. But, you know, the side of Bill Clinton that womanized and caused all that ruckus and disaster is just a shame. I mean, his presidency didn't need to be ruined by all of it.
It's fascinating. Jim Robinaud has been the guest. It's always goes by too fast, and it's always a lot of fun talking with you. Jim, I hope we talk again soon.
Scott, you do great work. I'm always happy to talk to you.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
We're going to take a 10-minute break, come back with more President's Day, and you on the toll-free line, 740-383-9944.
Yes.
148?
Oh, I don't know about 148.
Hope not.
That's